equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettinger, today's host for Equal Time, and this is the last time for a while, at least, that I'll be here on Wednesdays. Wednesdays was my regular day last year, 2009. We've changed the schedule around a little bit with Anthony Polina coming back to the show. Generally, I'll be in on Mondays, Travin will be in on Tuesdays, and Anthony will be here on Wednesdays and Thursdays. But I'd already lined up some guests for this particular Wednesday back last month before we decided on those changes, so that's why I'm in here today. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, in the local economy at the end of the age of oil, and we've got a great show today to talk about those issues. Our first guest will be Terry Tamminen. He's a special advisor to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and former head of the California Environmental Protection Agency. He'll be talking about his book, Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Addiction to Oil. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking with Jen Filio. She's a Northeast Coordinator for Clean, which is a collaborative organization with individuals and other groups working on energy. She'll be talking about the Citizens Clean Energy Economy Investment Act, in which decentralized energy generated by regionally appropriate, reliable, and renewable resources is pushed in a number of ways. First off, I want to get to a couple of announcements. First of all, Rob Williams, who was the Monday host last year, is I mentioned before that he's gone over to WMRW to have a continual presence on Vermont airwaves. That's over in the Mad River Valley, low power station, not available to most DEV listeners. But his new time there is Tuesdays from 11 to 12 a.m. If you're interested in keeping up with Rob Williams, of course he also writes a lot on Vermont Commons website, vtcommons.org, where I write a blog. Just go to vtcommons.org. And click on the blog, and you get to my blog, Relocalizing Vermont. A lot of other people blog there as well. And the new issue of Vermont Commons, which is going to be published every other month in 2009, is just hitting the streets very soon, and you can read it already online there at the website. First of all, we'll go to our guest, Terry Tamminen. He's the author of Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction. Terry, welcome to Equal Time.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
You have this book that came out originally in 2006, and now it's being reissued in paperback. Is that correct?
That's correct, and an updated foreword with some new information. And sad to say, many of the predictions made in the book a few years ago have now come true, and so it tries to put that in a bit of context.
Well, we'll get to those predictions in a minute, but let's hear from you. What is the true cost of our oil addiction?
Well, there's a couple of ways to measure it, as the title implies, which, by the way, my 15-year-old son came up with that title. We do pay for our oil addiction with lives, starting with the air pollution that is created. 100,000 people die in this country prematurely every year from petroleum-related air pollution. 6.5 million more go to the hospital with asthma and other respiratory diseases. Of course, we are literally killing people to get that oil in places like Iraq, which Alan Greenspan and other members of the Bush administration have long said that the war was entirely about oil. I think at this point everyone would agree at least part of it is. At this point, even President Bush has admitted that the continued presence there, he said in a statement a couple of months ago, is about keeping the oil from the hands of the terrorists. So it really is about oil. In the book, I talk about some firsthand experiences in places like Nigeria and Colombia, Ecuador, places where oil companies have been allowed to go in with no environmental regulation and basically destroy landscapes, destroy entire villages, get out the oil, and then leave toxic waste dumps with indigenous people who have no hope of restoring their way of life. And, you know, I mean, the list just kind of goes on in terms of those lives. The other cost, of course, is money, and that is for subsidies to the oil industry, which just really blow your mind when you think about, you know, government subsidizes all kinds of industries. We're asking them to provide incentives for things like solar at the moment, but only because the playing field is so unlevel. Incentives may be appropriate when an industry is starting up and you're hoping to get them off the ground, but the oil industry hardly needs that help anymore, and yet they get hundreds of billions of dollars a year in actual subsidies, tax breaks, and payments and things from various levels of government. And then, of course, if you take the health care costs, just like tobacco was imposing health care costs on taxpayers, the same thing is true with that petroleum-related illness I mentioned before, which adds billions of dollars to health care costs that all of us pay. And when you tally all that up, it's $2,700 for every man, woman, and child in America every single year of costs that are actually on someone's balance sheet. And you could even add to that the cost of, say, lost work days or lost productivity from someone who has asthma and can't go to work. But those are hard numbers to get your arms around, so I don't even include that in that $2,700 per person.
So here in Vermont, we have some discussions continually about the transportation fund. We have a special fund for transportation-related projects, which is funded by tax on gasoline and diesel. And for a long time, that's been used for other purposes that some people argue that general funds ought to be used for. Listening to your numbers, talking about a $2,700 subsidy for oil, gas, transportation, health care costs, and so on, per person in the U.S., it sounds like the rate is really the other way around, that we should be taxing gas and oil a lot more, doing something to reduce this cost.
You're right, or at least I would advocate just eliminating the subsidies and let the true cost be known. I mean, if you take that $2,700, another way to look at it is it ends up being about $7 or $8 per gallon of gasoline or diesel fuel sold in this country on top of whatever we're paying at the pump. So if you stop the subsidies, and by the way, that figure also does not include the cost of the war in Iraq, although it does include some defense costs, which even the Pentagon states on its balance sheet are for defending oil shipping lanes and oil tankers and so on, and oil pipelines. We spend $100 million in Colombia every year defending one oil pipeline, for example. So when you add all of that sort of thing in, my suggestion is, let these companies pay this for themselves from their astonishing profits. It's not like they can't afford it. And then the playing field is truly level for the alternatives. And my book, Lives Per Gallon, has an ominous title, but a happy ending. A lot of the book is dedicated to how we work our way out of this. But these alternative technologies, batteries and biofuels and hydrogen and so forth, can't compete as long as the incumbents are so heavily subsidized.
Mm. And most of the recommendations that you make are directed at subsidies and other actions, policies that exist at the federal level, because that's where a lot of the subsidies are. What can states do?
States can actually do a lot, and one of the strategies I mentioned in the book is I spent some time in the book talking about how similar oil companies have behaved when you compare them to tobacco companies, lying about the science, creating front groups, literally getting up in front of regulatory bodies, including when I was Secretary of California's EPA, coming into regulatory entities within Cal-EPA and lying to regulators on the record. I mean, the very same pattern and practice that the tobacco companies had. Well, what states did in that instance was state attorneys general went after the tobacco companies and said, we're going to hold you accountable for these lies and deceptions and force you to disgorge some of your huge profits to pay back the taxpayer for health care or other directly related costs. And that led to hundreds of billions of dollars of settlements and money that is now pouring back into anti-smoking campaigns and into state treasuries for obviously much more beneficial uses. And so in the book, I lay out the legal strategy that says, frankly, since oil companies have acted the same as tobacco companies over a demonstrated 70 or more year period, they should be treated like tobacco companies, and we should do the same, go to court and force them to at least compensate the taxpayers for things like the cost of health care.
We're talking with Terry Tamman, and he's the author of Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction, a special advisor to the governor of California, former secretary of the California EPA. The numbers here are 244-1777 and 877-291-8255. Now, Terry, you're out in California. We're here in Vermont. And as far as this sort of legal action goes, Vermont and California are already sort of joined at the hip. Can you describe how that's working right now?
Well, sure. I mean, Vermont has been a leader in things like supporting California's tailpipe standards for emissions of all kinds, but especially the greenhouse gas emissions that come from tailpipes, and has joined with California in court in trying to defend those rights. And in fact, the courts have, in fact, ruled in our mutual favors. Of course, that led to the requirement then that the U.S. EPA take action, and under the Bush administration, that has not happened. But we're confident that under the Obama administration, we will get the appropriate permissions now that the court has cleared the way for both California and Vermont to require that cars be cleaner over time, and particularly with respect to greenhouse gas emissions. And that, by the way, when you ask the first question at the top of the show about what's the true cost of our oil addiction, is another huge one that I didn't mention in that litany, which is, of course, a huge contribution to greenhouse gas emissions and global warming, which is something because those emissions will be in the atmosphere for so long. I mean, my grandfather's vehicle emissions are still in the atmosphere contributing to global warming. And so when you think about that, these are a price that we're going to be paying for many years to come.
Mm. You mentioned the Obama EPA will have the opportunity to overturn action of the Bush EPA in blocking Vermont and California and other states from adopting greenhouse gas regulations for automobile emissions. There's still a couple lawsuits pending, one that was adjudicated here in Vermont in Judge William Sessions' court, one that was out in California that are on appeal. The automakers and the auto associations are still trying to block these new greenhouse gas emission standards. Isn't that still correct?
It is, and it's sad, you know, given all of the money that Congress has already lavished on the domestic automakers, and really they're in the trouble they're in because of their own inefficiency, and as I talk about in the book, you know, all the various things they've done to protect their business as usual instead of simply being more competitive and selling more cars and being more profitable that way. They've poured money into campaigns of congressional and presidential candidates, $186 million in the last 10 years, and that in turn has, between the oil and the auto companies, and that in turn has protected them, but it's protecting them right out of business. So now we're subsidizing them, and even as we're doing that, they're still, instead of saying, okay, look, if you subsidize us, we'll start making these more fuel-efficient cars and the ones that that reduce greenhouse gases, they're still saying, you know, no, we want to undermine those rights of the states. And so, again, I think a lot of that will come to an end under this new Congress and under President Obama.
So there was talk last month of tying the bailout to the auto industry to regulations or to requirements that they drop their appeals of these two legal cases. And you have hope that didn't happen. You have hope that those requirements will be made in the upcoming administration in Congress?
You know, I do, and I think Congress gets this now, and I think that, you know, you could easily see as a measure, you know, President-elect Obama at a governor's global climate summit we hosted here about a month ago, shortly after his election, stated that he endorses what the states are doing on climate change and will commit the United States to reducing greenhouse gases back to the 1990 levels by 2020 and an 80% reduction by 2050. And so I think, and he's very sincere about this, I think he realizes one of the ways that you'll contribute to those reductions are essentially federalizing what California and Vermont have started. And so with or without the car companies dropping their appeals, I could see, as part of a comprehensive climate plan, Congress making those car standards the law of the land, and obviously they're, you know, the whole challenge would become moot.
It would be an end run around it, because right now the legal challenge is that California should not have stricter standards than the U.S. EPA does.
Right, and yet we, of course, going all the way back to the very foundation of the Clean Air Act, have those unique rights because California had a Clean Air Act before the federal one, and so we've always had unique rights to go farther than the federal government. And, you know, it's interesting, over the last two or three years, there were about a dozen comprehensive bills introduced into Congress about climate change. And just last year, the Warner-Lieberman bill, although it didn't pass, it was the first one to say that Congress would set a floor, not a ceiling. It would allow states to do more to reduce greenhouse gases, which obviously would include covering cars. And so I think that's kind of the path that Congress will take going forward. I think they'll pick up that Warner-Lieberman approach and create perhaps a national cap and trade program or some other standards, but it will all be a floor, not a ceiling, and they will, because I think they realize that California, Vermont, these other leadership states have done so much, and you have bipartisan support from Democrats and Republicans in these states. Why would you undo that? Rather use it as a springboard for federal action.
Our junior senator, Bernie Sanders, who took the seat vacated by Jim Jeffords, reintroduced Jim Jeffords' climate change bill, which, as I understand it, was the most ambitious climate change bill introduced in the last Congress. What are your thoughts on that bill? Have you looked at it?
I have, and I actually, during the primaries on my website, I actually put up report cards of each of the candidates in both parties about their climate change policies or, you know, renewable energy policies and energy independence policies. And I compared it to that as a standard because I do believe that that is kind of the gold standard. Mr. Sanders has done a great job on that. And, you know, I think Lieberman Warner kind of took it one step further. I don't think the two are at all in conflict. I think Sanders' measure kind of sets a great plan, and it also set a limit. It said, for example, that that the goal of federal policy ought to be to keep greenhouse gases from exceeding a certain level, and that if they did, and all of these things that we're doing under this new law were not enough, that the administrator of the EPA would have to come back to Congress with more measures. I mean, it had a lot of very smart policy in it, so I'm a big fan.
Okay. Well, Terry Tamminen, author of Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction. At the beginning of the show, you're talking about the original edition of this book that came out in 2006 and some of the predictions that since then have come true. Tell us about some of those.
Well, of course, the continued year-after-year statistics showing up about the health impacts and more studies that show the particular connection to petroleum-related air pollution, you know. 10, 20 years ago, the science wasn't good enough. We simply knew people were smoking, they were inhaling air pollution, and it wasn't good. But we couldn't tell if someone had asthma or emphysema, you know, which type of pollution had caused it. And there's still a certain amount of that difficulty. But we do know, for example, now that a child, for example, who lives within a mile of a busy freeway loses 1% of his or her lung function every year.
1% per year.
Per year.
Wow.
You know, we know that many of the other impacts, especially of particulate pollution, which is mostly related to diesel trucks and buses and so forth, gets deep into the lungs. It does things like the particles actually get through the walls of the lungs into the bloodstream and thicken your blood, much like when you add flour to the turkey grease and make gravy at Thanksgiving.
What an image.
Yeah, no, I mean, it literally thickens your blood, and those pollutants get into the bloodstream of pregnant women and actually cause health harms to the fetus before you're ever born. I mean, so sadly, you know, more and more studies in these last 2 years have continued to confirm those kinds of findings.
Before you get off of that, I mean, just want to underline this number that you put out at the beginning of the show, that 100,000 people in this country die prematurely from petroleum-related pollution. That's compared to, I haven't seen the latest statistics, but around 40,000, is it, who die in crashes related to automobiles?
Yes, right, that's right.
So
yeah.
2.5 times as many people die from pollution related to petroleum as die in car crashes in this country.
Exactly,
wow.
That's exactly right. You know, also sadly, as we saw the price spikes over the summer, and, you know, now because of the economic downturn, we're enjoying maybe some lower prices, but they'll go right back up for all the reasons I cite in the book, that we're running out of oil, that as we do, we're spending more and more money, more and more energy to get what's left. The competition is growing fiercely, and in the foreword to the book, I talk about some secret meetings that were held between shadowy government and pseudo-government agencies between the U.S. and China, essentially carving up some of the world's supplies, recognizing it's a dwindling resource and we're all fighting for it. That fight has only taken a pause because of the economic downturn, but believe me, as the economy goes back, we don't have enough industrial capacity, refineries, and so on to turn the oil into something useful, and so there's competition for refined fuels as much as there is for the crude oil itself. And again, a lot of those predictions are sadly coming true or will continue to come true in the near future.
There was one prediction in there from the California Economic Council, I believe it was, that there might be $5 gas sometime soon. And I think you saw that out in California this summer.
Yeah, yes, yeah, we sure did. And I know when I first put that out there, I had a lot of people raise their eyebrows and say, you know, you got to be crazy. It certainly isn't going to happen in the next 10 or 15 years. And it happened within 2 years. The good news, though, Carl, is that some of the predictions I made for good things, the last half of the book is dedicated to how we work our way out of this, and many of those predictions are coming true as well. You've seen a renaissance of battery technology in cars, Bill Ford getting out in front of his new battery cars, and General Motors talking about plug-in hybrids when, in the book, I cite how they lied to me for years about as a regulator, lied to me about when they were going to deliver hybrids, and it was always next spring. And, you know, next spring would come, and they'd have an excuse for why they hadn't put hybrids in any of their cars,
isn't
let alone...
Isn't that when the Volt is coming?
Well, it is, and I question whether or not the Volt will ever be mass-produced by a company like GM, and we can get into a whole separate discussion about that. But again, at least they're talking about it. They're moving in that direction. And one of the things that I think has the greatest promise for our country is hydrogen, and I drive a hydrogen-powered car, which is manufactured by Honda. They're actually going to be delivering to me in the spring a hydrogen home fueler, which is a small appliance that I'll hook up to my solar panel, and solar electricity will be used to break hydrogen out of water, and I will power my car with the hydrogen that I make from the roof of my garage. So that's coming to pass. We created a hydrogen highway program here in California that I talk about in the book. And sure enough, a couple of years later, we've got 30-plus stations in California so that whether I get the hydrogen from my roof or if I'm driving across the state, I can refuel easily. And so those alternatives are also now coming to pass.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is the peak in world oil production, and you seem to be comfortable with assessing the peak to be occurring right about now, plus or minus a few years. Is that fair to say?
It is. I think that is right, especially, I actually don't think there's a whole lot of disagreement among experts. The disagreement is what do you put into the equation in the first instance in terms of how much oil there is? And, you know, I think those who believe that we've hit peak sooner are saying we can't really include in the world's inventory some of the oil that's locked up in shale and tar sands because it takes four or more units of energy input to get out and refine a gallon of gasoline in terms of the energy you would get out of it. And at some point, you can't keep putting in four units to get out one unit. Even the tar sands in Alberta and Canada, the equation is about 2.5 to 1. So I think if you set aside some of those reserves that appear to exist, but we will never, ever commercially exploit, then, you know, clearly we've hit peak oil. Those who believe we will commercially exploit those might say you've got 10 or 20 more years, but nobody thinks we've got, you know, till the end of the century.
So how does that work then? We're at or about at peak oil right now. The first federally funded major report on peak oil, the Hirsch Report, looked at the rate of conversion to new technologies like these battery cars, these hydrogen power cars that you were talking about, to respond to peak oil. And the authors of that report concluded that you know, we have such a long turnover time in our auto fleet is probably longer in California than it is here in Vermont because your cars don't rust as fast out there. But we've got such a long turnover time, it's such a big investment to buy a new car that we'd need 2 decades before peak oil to start a crash course of conversion in order to avoid severe dislocations. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's certainly some truth to that. I mean, I think, though, that you saw just a little glimpse of it this past summer when oil prices went up so quickly and suddenly dealers couldn't give away SUVs. Mm-hmm. And within a matter of months, General Motors and Ford shut down virtually all of their SUV production. And so, yes, that's dislocation to be sure, but now here they are standing in front of their shiny new battery hybrids and hydrogen cars and alternatives, which clearly those same factories can be used to turn out. At less extreme ends of that scale, you just have more demand for cars that are more fuel efficient. And as Bill Ford said, you know, the other night when people said, well, don't you think the $2 gasoline is going to make people go back? And he said, no. He said, we're not seeing that. That's why we discontinued most of our SUVs, that instead people are, you know, that's fresh in their minds. They know that those prices will go back up. And so, you know, at a minimum, we're going to be selling more fuel-efficient cars. At a maximum, we're going to be moving to alternatives more quickly. And, you know, again, I think necessity is the mother of invention. We, going all the way back to World War II, when we had to, in a short period of time, we converted most of our industrial capacity in this country to a wartime footing. And within a couple of years, we produced enough material to win a world war. So I think, and then right after the war, obviously converted it back to peacetime. So if we can do it back then with the technology we had 60, 70 years ago, I think we can do it again.
One major difference between now and then was that the availability of energy to us was increasing. The world oil production was increasing in that phase. And now it's, you know, leveling off and maybe about to start decreasing at the same time that there are other countries in the world that are in a lot better financial shape than the U.S. is. And they're accelerating their industrialization. I'm thinking India. I'm thinking China. And they're competing with us, as you so well outline in the book, for the available oil resources. Doesn't that put real crimps on how fast we can respond now compared to in the 1940s?
It does, although remember in the 1940s, I know my parents talk about it, and there's probably people listening to us now who remember this, there was gasoline rationing because of the World War that interrupted supply lines. It wasn't just that the war effort needed the refined fuel. It was that places in the Middle East and other places that had a lot of the oil were not able to export, and refineries were destroyed, and there was competition because of the German and Japanese war effort. In fact, as I talk about in the book, a good deal of the reason for World War II was about oil. And so even back then, although, yes, we hadn't reached peak oil, there was at least a temporary shortage, or you might sort of say a temporary peak oil, because of geopolitical events. And that's another reason that we just can't wait. Sheikh Yamani, who founded OPEC, famously said the Stone Age didn't end for lack of stones, and the oil age will not end for lack of oil. It's when it just becomes too hard to get, too difficult to refine, and too much competition for it that people will start to make a shift.
I was surprised overall at how car-centric your book is. So you give two scenarios for 2025, and even in the nightmare scenario, you have 75% of the people in the U.S. driving foreign cars. And I'd be surprised if 75% of the people own any car in 2025, the way things are going. Don't we need to ignore cars a lot more than we have been and prepare for a massive change in how we get around, how much we travel, how we feed ourselves and try to relocalize food production and manufacturing, make ourselves more resilient as a society rather than try to save the automobile?
We do. And you know, I think when I say in the book 75% of the people driving are driving foreign cars, but I would agree with you that overall number has to decrease. You're absolutely right. We've got to focus more on the local, and I think where we do need to transport ourselves, much of that will be in cyberspace in the future. I was asked to talk about three business trends for Fast Company magazine recently, and I said one of them I think that you're going to see an explosion of in the next year or two is video conferencing. It's getting better. I was actually on American Airlines the other night flying back from New York, and they now have wireless internet, high-speed wireless internet on the entire flight.
Wow.
And there was a guy sitting there with his laptop with a little camera on it, actually doing a video conference on the airplane at 40,000 feet.
That must have been annoying to sit next to.
Well, it sort of was. I mean, it was with his kids, actually. I mean, I say a video conference, but I mean, it was just his family. And so the point is that as that technology gets faster, better, cheaper, people don't need to get into their cars. I also think, thanks to the current crisis...
They just get into their airplanes.
Well, yeah, but I mean, multitasking. Sure. The good news about the stimulus package and the current administration is they understand the benefit of investing in mass transit.
Right.
And I think finding ways, as I talk about in the book also, that part of the solution is getting out of the car. I totally agree with that. Mm-hmm. And then certainly doing things like sourcing our food supply closer to home. Tesco and some of the other big supermarket chains around the world are starting to put food miles labels on products as people become more concerned about carbon footprint. So I do think that trend is changing as well. You're right. Hmm.
Terry Tamminen is a special advisor to Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California. He's the author of Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction. Terry, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Take care.
You too.